For years now, many politicians, political analysts, and everyday voters have been shocked by the rhetoric and the actions of President Trump, calling them extreme, unprecedented, and even authoritarian.
We also saw the president this week demonstrate once again that he has no respect for the rule of law.
I worry very much when we have a president who I fear very much is moving us in a very authoritarian direction.
Right in front of our eyes, we are watching a descent into authoritarianism.
And since the president has been acquitted in his impeachment trial, he's moved even faster to consolidate power and oust people who he considers insufficiently loyal to him. But as we in the U.S. look at history to try and understand and contextualize Trump's actions, around the world we're seeing a rise in leaders who are also changing the norms and institutions of their countries, places where the threat of authoritarianism is very real. So we decided to talk to three people who have expertise in different parts of the world, in Europe, Asia, and Latin America, to see what lessons other countries have for what we're seeing in the U.S. right now.
My name is Joshua Kurlansik, and I'm Senior Fellow for Southeast Asia at the Council on Foreign Relations.
My name is Yasha Monk. I'm an Associate Professor at Johns Hopkins University, and the author of The People versus Democracy.
My name is Alejandro Velasco. I'm an Associate Professor of Latin American History at New York University.
And as you'll hear, they don't always agree about whether or not President Trump's actions compared to authoritarian leaders around the world.
I do think it's accurate to talk about Donald Trump as an aspiring authoritarian.
Comparing Donald Trump to someone like Duterte or even Jair Bolsonaro in Brazil, who's another prominent illiberal populist, I think it's a pretty significant stretch.
I don't actually think that Donald Trump is undermining U.S. institutions. He understands keenly how institutions and the institutional design of the United States can be actually deployed to satisfy authoritarian goals.
A lot to unpack here. We started the conversation with Yasha explaining the link between authoritarianism and populism, and talking about how populist leaders can exhibit authoritarian tendencies.
Now, what populists have in common is not an ideological hue, a set of economic policies they agree on, but they basically all say, I and I alone truly speak for the people. I'm the only legitimate expression of the people's will, and so if anybody disagrees with me, that's illegitimate. That has happened again and again in the history of democracy, and it has happened in many countries over the last 10 or 20 years. It was true of somebody like Hugo Chavez in Venezuela. It was also true of more right-wing populist leaders like Recep Erdogan in Turkey or Viktor Orban in Hungary. And I think the way to understand that is through this concept of populism. And what we've seen in the last years, and especially, may I say, in the last weeks, in the last months, is Donald Trump trying to politicize the Department of Justice, to purge, as we have just learned, members of the executive with whom he disagrees. And that's a way, I think, of saying all of the power should stem from him. We should concentrate more power in his own hands. And all of the kind of separation of power and the rule of law, which we need in order to sustain our individual liberties, which we need in order to sustain our ability to throw an elected leader out of office if we don't like him anymore, are things which he is quite hostile to.
Joshua, I'm curious. We hear this comparison between Donald Trump here in the U.S. and other leaders such as Erdogan. How do you see this comparison?
I mean, I think Trump is more classified perhaps with someone like Silvio Berlusconi, who was sort of an antecedent to some of these actors in Italy. Berlusconi then gave way to sort of, he corroded the discourse in Italy and led to other future populists, somewhat liberal populists. But I think comparing Donald Trump to someone like Duterte or even Jair Bolsonaro in Brazil, who's another prominent illiberal populist, I think it's a pretty significant stretch.
Look, I think it's important to be careful. And I certainly don't believe that Donald Trump at this point has undermined American democracy to any comparable extent as Recep Erdogan has done in Turkey. And it's very important to be explicit about that. Nevertheless, I fear it's possible to fall into a kind of false complacency. Autocrats have very often been elected when they first got into power. The question is whether they are willing to let the separation of powers and the rule of law operate in such a way that it's easy to throw them out of office again. And that has not always been the case. Where the phrase of authoritarian populism is useful to me, nevertheless, is that it describes a set of political actors, which include both Donald Trump and people like Jair Bolsonaro and people like Recep Erdogan, who derive from their claim that they alone represent the people a disdain for the rule of law and for checks and balances.
Alejandro?
You know, there is a way in which populism and authoritarianism get conflated as one-to-one, but in fact, what has been historically true in Latin America is that the nature of the previously existing regime also not only constrains, but also enables other forms of politics to rise. And so in the 20th century, for instance, it has been at the hand of what we would call populists, where the greatest expansion of social and economic rights have come. And that's because historically institutions, the kinds of things that we valorize and hold aloft in places like, you know, Western Europe or the United States, have been the bulwarks of entrenched elites. And that grants these populist leaders some degree of legitimacy. In the case of somebody like Donald Trump, certainly you see the concentration of executive power, the requirement of loyalty. But to some extent, of course, this ignores the fact that these are not historically new in the history of the United States. Even the idea of how, you know, we elect our presidents in the United States is highly contestable, right? And so to some extent, what Trump has done is highlighted some of these deeper deficiencies in the institutional apparatus in the United States rather than started them anew. And so I would also caution against seeing what Trump is doing as somehow new or different, and to some extent understand it as part and parcel of longer histories of political marginalization in the United States.
Just briefly, I mean, I wanted to say that I think another issue is that in the United States, we seem to be consistently looking at Trump and comparing him to Orban or Duterte or whoever else, when in reality there was for a long time in the United States, a system in the South that was essentially very similar to what we're talking about, you know, a democratic facade, which it was essentially an authoritarian system in which a variety of different populists ruled state and local elections, completely disenfranchised voters, saw themselves as the epitome of the popular will, et cetera, et cetera. And so I think actually one of the mistakes the last few years is to constantly look to, although there are similarities, so to constantly think that this is something new that has happened in the United States and shocking, whereas to recognize that in actuality in the United States we had long, long periods of this in large swaths of the country, and most of the old Confederacy, in which many or all of the characteristics that we're describing here were actually in place.
Right now we see that the president is finishing up a trip in India, is buddy-buddy with Narendra Modi, another person who invokes this term of authoritarianism. Do leaders who ascribe to these kinds of principles, do they tend to learn from each other's playbook?
Yeah, I think this is one of the obvious ways in which we're protesting a little bit too much in this conversation, saying, oh my God, I mean, you know, really to try and compare Donald Trump to somebody like Jair Bolsonaro or somebody like Narendra Modi is completely wrong. But what's striking is the extent to which Donald Trump sees himself as the natural ally of all of the different people who we've mentioned in this conversation, with the exception of some of the left-wing populists like Hugo Chavez. He sees himself as ideologically aligned to Viktor Orban. He sees himself as ideologically aligned to Jair Bolsonaro and now Narendra Modi in India. And I think that he's onto something there.
I just want to thank and congratulate, though, President Erdogan. He's a friend of mine, and I'm glad we didn't have a problem because, frankly, he's a hell of a leader, and he's a tough man. He's a strong man.
Brazil's relationship with the United States because of our friendship is probably better than it's ever been by far.
Viktor Orban has done a tremendous job in so many different ways. Highly respected, respected all over Europe. Probably, like me, a little bit controversial, but that's okay.
They share a vision of politics. They share an impatience, a disrespect for the idea that there might be true political pluralism, that decent people can come to different conclusions about what we should do in our countries or who our leader should be. I still believe that that is the best framework for understanding this political moment in the United States and in India and in Brazil and in large parts of Europe. The fact that Donald Trump's attorney general has asked prosecutors to reduce their suggestions for what kind of prison term Roger Stone should have. This is an explicit way in which the president and his allies are trying to influence how justice is done in a criminal trial.
The forewoman of the jury
the woman who was in charge of the jury is totally tainted. When you take a look, how can you have a person like this? She was a anti-Trump activist. Can you imagine this?
So I think this concept of authoritarian populism certainly helps us to understand what's going on here. And a lot of these kinds of news stories, if you changed a few names and changed a few geographical locations, look eerily like what you might have read about Turkey, about some of those other countries like Hungary 5 or 10 years ago.
Alejandro, I saw you kind of grimacing a minute ago. What was that all about?
Yeah. No, I guess I just listening to Yasha, there's much of what he says that I agree with. But the fact is that the institutions of the state that we used to, you know, hold up as the reasons why the United States, U.S. democracy was more expansive and more representative are, in fact, working. And they're just working on behalf of their particular interests, which is to stay in power. The impeachment trial, right, you could say many things about it, but in the end, institutionally, procedurally, it actually functioned as designed. But I also think it is, to some extent, to use Josh's words, naive to imagine that the institutions of the United States are already or had been, you know, somewhat as strong as is being suggested.
Joshua, when we see populist leaders leaving office, what tends to happen?
Well, sometimes they don't leave office willingly, at least in Southeast Asia. And you have a secondary problem in which people who desperately want to get rid of a liberal populist themselves become fixated with a variety of white knight solutions. You also have a problem where a lot of times in the face of these illiberal populists, opposition fractures. Sometimes it fractures even before they come into office, and they spend their time squabbling rather than recognizing the greatest threat. This has certainly happened in the Philippines. It's happened in Thailand. I mean, you could argue it's happened in a lot of places. And the second thing that often happens is once, even if you were able to get that liberal populist out of office, you've often created a situation in which he or she has so degraded institutions and the political discourse that people are distrustful and cynical. And what happens is you wind up with a future, another illiberal populist in office, sometimes even worse. So that's a second problematic scenario that can happen.
Well, I mean, right now we're looking at the Democratic Party, you know, who seems to be panicking over the possibility of Bernie Sanders becoming the nominee. Alejandro, is there anything you want to draw upon from the Latin American context that you think is germane to this conversation?
Yeah, actually, I think what Josh was mentioning before about the opposition tending to splinter as they try to challenge authoritarians is right on. And I completely agree with what you mentioned, that that is to some extent what we're seeing in terms of the Democratic Party splintering and this sort of hyperventilation about Bernie Sanders' potential to challenge Trump. You know, I guess the other thing that I would say in terms of Latin America is that this other example of the white knight is something we've seen recently, right? So in places like Venezuela, you know, Juan Guaido, who emerged last year as a potential alternative to Maduro, you know, came in sort of with the support of the United States and many other Western democracies, but also was doing so, you know, holding up a message that all they needed to do was to get the support in order to oust Maduro from power. And that was a fundamental misreading of the dynamics of how deeply entrenched, as Yasha was mentioning, authoritarians, you know, become quite quickly, as in the case of Nicolas Maduro. So yeah, Latin America certainly poses examples, although I would say this and I would insist on the point, I don't actually think that Donald Trump is undermining U.S. institutions. I think what's particular and sui generis and unique about Donald Trump is that he understands keenly how institutions and the institutional design of the United States can be actually deployed to satisfy authoritarian goals.
And so you think he's a one-off and that if he were to be, I guess, succeeded by someone else, that the institutions would hold?
No, I feel like the issue is that the institutions are holding him, right? Yeah. So, for instance, I don't think that his electoral strategy is to win the popular vote. I think the electoral strategy is to win the Electoral College. But it is entirely plausible that you might have another, perhaps wider, popular majority margin that, in fact, does not lead to the election of that candidate. And so, you know, would that be considered a failure of institutions? I am again and again surprised by how little talk there is of electoral college reform in the context of thinking precisely about these questions about the solidity or lack thereof of U.S. institutions. That is the fundamental one. You can have free and fair elections. You can have low barriers to entry. You can have significant amounts of voter turnout. But in the end, it is entirely plausible that the popular majority candidate does not win. And I feel like one more of those elections would prove the point, actually, that it's not the failure of U.S. institutions to harness somebody like Donald Trump, but it is embedded in their original design that allows this to happen.
I've been speaking with Alejandro Velasco, associate professor at NYU, Joshua Kurlancic, senior fellow for Southeast Asia at the Council on Foreign Relations, and Yasha Monk, associate professor at Johns Hopkins School of Advanced International Studies. All of you, thanks so much for joining me today.
Thank you.
Thank you.
There's a lot going on right now. Mounting economic inequality, threats to democracy, environmental disaster, the sour stench of chaos in the air. I'm Brooke Gladstone, host of WNYC's On the Media. Want to understand the reasons and the meanings of the narratives that led us here, and maybe how to head them off at the pass? That's On the Media's specialty. Take a listen wherever you get your podcasts.